This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Governor Pat McCrory released his first budget plan this week, and it's our first look at the new governor's priorities. We'll examine the proposal and other developments this week with our Friday roundtable. Joining me in the studio, WUNC education reporter Dave DeWitt, Capitol Bureau Chief Jessica Jones, and with us from a studio at WCQS in Asheville is John Elliston, investigations and open government editor with Carolina Public Press, a nonprofit online news organization that serves Western North Carolina. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks.
Hi, Frank.
Thank you.
Jessica, give us an overview of this budget proposal.
Well, it's a very careful budget that really doesn't spend a lot of money when you compare it to budget proposals put forward by governors in the past. It's a $20.6 billion budget. It sets aside money for emergencies, for state building repairs, and Medicaid costs, but it's pretty light on creating any major new programs.
So, Dave, what's the big takeaway from this? Most of the spending, $11 billion, is in education.
Yeah, and that's always more than half the budget itself and always sort of the big expenditure. And it's also where governors can really implement their policy. Every governor in the state of North Carolina for the last several decades loves to call themselves the education governor, largely because that's where they can have a real impact. It's harder in other areas where there's a lot more sort of defined rules. In education, you can start new programs. You can do all kinds of different things that you can then run on in the future, but also you can sort of attach your legacy to. And what Governor McCrory has shown in this budget vis-a-vis education is that he started a program about safety in education, and it's a center that he's going to start. And he funded that, and he's going to talk a lot about teachers in this budget. And it's going to be interesting as we move forward. A big education bill was also put forward on Wednesday. So, you know, how those things – this is all something the legislature wants to be involved in. So you see a lot of this moderation in education budgets. Cuts aren't too deep except the UNC system. So you're going to see Governor McCrory, as the budget goes along, I think he's going to fight for a lot of the education things he's got in there.
Good. And we're going to talk in detail about where the spending cuts are and where there's been some expansion and what all that means. But, John, I want to talk with you. What's getting particular notice in this budget in Western North Carolina?
Frank, off the bat, there are concerns about two specific cuts in the governor's budget, and these would close two of the three state historic sites in Western North Carolina. One of them is a small mountain history museum in Old Fort, and one is the birthplace of Zebulon Vance, our Civil War era governor, which is here in Buncombe County. Neither of these sites employs a lot of staffers. It's just a handful of direct jobs that would be on the chopping block. But the concern is that you're taking away a tourism anchor, particularly for Old Fort, which is a town of about 1,000 people and uses the Mountain Gateway Museum for all sorts of community purposes.
Kind of interesting, because these are issues that would be totally off the map here in the Triangle and really elsewhere in the state. But when it comes to the tourism budget and the tourism economy in the western part of the state, those two little sites are very important budget items, I guess, huh, John?
Absolutely. Heritage tourism is a big component of the tourism here. And as I said, these are relatively small institutions. You might almost call them quaint, but they're important to the communities around them.
And also the governor's eugenics compensation proposal, and maybe I'll have you describe that, is also very important out there in the western part of the state.
Yes. The governor has proposed, I believe it's about $10 million allotted to compensate victims of North Carolina's sterilization program, which sterilized about 7,600 people through the years. In Buncombe County, we're something of an anomaly in the mountains in that we had a very active eugenics or sterilization program. We had the fifth most in the state. So if this compensation package were to come through, it's conceivable that some of the confirmed victims here might be compensated.
Dave DeWitt, let's dive a little deeper into this education budget. Of course, as we said, the biggest part of the budget, $11 billion of 20.6, devoted to education. What are the headline numbers in this proposal?
Well, I think the headline number is that the UNC system sees about another $130 million in cuts, and that's on top of $400 million in cuts the last couple of years. That has a lot of UNC system leaders concerned, to say the least. But what's interesting about it, too, is that it also caps in-state tuition so that in-state tuition cannot be raised at these universities. So in a way, that squeezes the campuses. There are only a couple of ways you can get revenue if you're a state university in North Carolina. One is from the state, and one is through tuition revenue, in-state and out-of-state. And we're going to see out-of-state raises, but that really only affects a handful of campuses. You know, UNC Chapel Hill, NC State, North Carolina A&T, But a lot of schools don't even come close to the level of out-of-state students that they're allowed to have. So that's, you know, that's going to be a real squeeze on a lot of UNC system campuses. Community colleges did not get cut as much, but community college system president Scott Rawls told me that, you know, it is going to have an effect. There are certain projects and programs that are going to get funded a little bit higher that Governor McCrory likes, and you know, President Rawls likes that, but the operating expenditures will be less. And they tied that into a little bit of a decline in enrollment now that the economy is getting a little bit better. Community college enrollment's going down a little bit, and the funding will too.
So big hit in higher education, but more spending for pre-K, and we have more classroom teachers and fewer aides. So tell us about that package, pre-K through 12.
Right. Governor McCrory proposes that 5,000 more slots be made available for at-risk kids in pre-K programs. That was a nice surprise for the people who advocate for pre-K programs in the state. And then 1,800 additional teachers statewide. But as you said, 3,000 fewer teacher assistants in grades 2 and 3. So, but it also, the education bill that was introduced before the budget would give superintendents and presidents some leeway in ability to keep a teacher assistant here and maybe lose a teaching position here. So that local control is kind of built into this.
With more teachers, does, when you think about losing an assistant, that immediately makes you think about more work for the teacher. And yet it might mean smaller class size because you've got more teachers.
That's exactly right. And that's the idea, is that different districts have different needs. And there are some districts in the state that are really growing. And there are some districts in this state that are stagnant or getting a little bit smaller. And so you may decide, okay, we can have a teacher here with an assistant in a class of 25, and that works well for our school. But you might have a teacher with 28 students and no assistant in some other places. So it's going to be, if it all gets through the system, and that's a big if, it's going to be a little bit more local control on what they want. But, you know, in the aggregate, it's still a cut because 3,000 teacher assistant positions that's how they're paying for the 1,800 teachers. Yeah. So they're not all of a sudden allocating more money for teachers. It's essentially the same amount of money. They're just telling people, well, we'd rather you do this than this.
Jessica, Dave just said it's a big if, but why? GOP controls both houses of the legislature and the governor's mansion. Don't we simply know that this is going to go through? What are the Democrats saying, and what's the debate going forward?
Well, the Democrats in the legislature are really not very happy with the governor's budget proposal. They say that it benefits some urban areas and is terrible for rural areas, is terrible for economically disadvantaged areas all over the state. The governor's budget would also close 5 rural prisons, which in rural areas really bring in a lot of jobs and a lot of industry, and they're all good for the economy in those places. They say rural hospitals will have to pay more in Medicaid costs, and plus the state already is not expanding the Medicaid program, which could bring in extra federal dollars. And then the governor's budget also proposes moving the Golden Leaf Foundation's annual $65 million appropriation to the general fund, and it cuts a big chunk of money from the North Carolina Rural Center. And so these are all organizations that help to funnel money to some of these communities that need a little extra boost. And I would also add, many counties benefit from these organizations that currently have very, very high unemployment rates.
And John Elliston at the Carolina Public Press, the hit that rural counties might take is being felt acutely out there in the western part of the state, particularly the decision not to expand Medicaid and take federal dollars. And I understand people are really organizing out in your part of the state about that decision. Tell us more.
Last week, we had a very well-attended forum at UNC Asheville that was attended by health advocates who are pointing up the specific risks in the western counties from rejecting the Medicaid expansion. 20% of people in this part of the state have no health insurance, and the argument's being made that about 110,000 people in western North Carolina would have qualified for Medicaid through the expansion. Rural areas, rural hospitals are saying that they're going to be particularly hard hit.
And that's more than 20% of the total projected number who would not have access. About 500,000 are denied access because of this. You say $110,000 people in your part of the state, and I guess it's not just Asheville, but all those rural counties there and the hospitals that serve those counties as well.
That's right. And so these advocates are trying to get ahead of the game for next year in the hopes that this decision might be reversed.
Dave, Governor McCrory raised a lot of eyebrows when he chose a businessman and conservative activist Art Pope to be his budget director. Do you see Pope's influence in this budget anywhere?
Absolutely. And I don't think there's any doubt that he is the person. And this happens in all administrations. You know, you have a budget director that gets into the weeds, and you've got a governor who says, I'm really interested in this, this, and this. Now go make it happen. And that's certainly happened here. But I would say that a lot of advocates, especially on the Democratic side, were a lot more concerned about certain things. They thought Art Pope was going to come in and really eviscerate the budget from their perspective. And I don't think anybody thinks that's what happened here with this budget. Most people say that it's a pretty moderate budget, and it has a lot of the fingerprints of McCrory on it. So, but there are specific programs, and you know, Jessica mentioned one, Golden Leaf, and Art Pope has been a long advocate against the Golden Leaf program. There are other projects within education, the North Carolina Advancement for Teaching. It was a big program that he was never a big fan of, and the other programs like that, you see the specific programs not getting funded that Art Pope has often talked about. So that's probably one of the influences he had.
And this is the budget. We've yet to see the tax proposal, and that's another opportunity for all kinds of influence
to
make its way into that package. Well, we're going to talk more about what's going on this week. Governor McCrory's budget proposal is in the news this Friday. WUNC's Dave DeWitt, Jessica Jones, and John Elliston of Carolina Public Press. Just ahead, we're going to talk about a reversal on driver's licenses for some undocumented immigrants and a possible reversal on a plan for Raleigh's Dorothea Dix Hospital. All part of our news roundup on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about the week's news on our Friday roundtable. This week, it's WUNC's Dave DeWitt and Jessica Jones in the studio. John Elliston is with us in Asheville. He is with Carolina Public Press. Jessica, pretty significant reversal yesterday afternoon, right? State DMV announces it will not be putting a big pink stripe on those driver's licenses for some undocumented immigrants in the state. What happened?
That's right. Well, there was a lot of criticism of the DOT's decision to put this pink stripe on driver's licenses for young immigrants who are in a federal program called DACA, which postpones their deportation for 2 years. However, I will say that the licenses that are being given to this group of young immigrants will still have language in red letters that says legal presence / no lawful status and limited term. So if you take a look at the license, you'll still see that. And so the ACLU has called the removal of the bright stripe a huge step in the right direction. But then there are other groups who are still protesting it because the driver's licenses are going to be clearly marked. They're clearly going to still look different.
There was a huge protest. To what extent did that play a part? What is DOT saying about why it changed its mind on this?
Well, DOT really isn't responding. They are not commenting on why the change was made. They have just said that the pink stripe is no longer going to be included. But it did raise many civil liberties advocates thought that it was a really bad idea to have this bright pink stripe that's reminiscent of all kinds of other ways to separate and to separate a group that may be disadvantaged.
All right. Well, let's move on a little bit. We'll talk about another example of more moderate policies. Again, Dave, you suggested in the first part of our program, we talked about the budget, more moderate than many people expected. Now we see this question of conservative ideology over sort of larger Republican politics. Maybe the more pragmatic wing of the GOP is keeping more conservative elements in check for the moment. What's the politics? What are the dynamics at the moment within the legislature in state government, complete control by the GOP, and yet we're now seeing limits? This driver's license issue seems to be one, maybe the budget another.
I think what you're seeing is what you see at the national level, which is you've got Republicans who are business oriented, who aren't as interested in the social issues as much, and they are interested in and I think Governor McCrory fits into this group very well. He was a very business friendly governor when he was the mayor in Charlotte. I think he's going to continue that. He's spoken often about a customer service mentality within government. And I think to him that means a customer service mentality toward business mostly. And so you've seen this sort of these chambers of commerce that have rallied behind him. And it's fascinating to me to watch, and we'll talk more about the Dix Hospital situation. But, you know, if you look at sort of these chambers of commerce that support it, things like Dix, and they support other things, and then you see a lot of legislators who are fairly new. There's a large group of folks, especially on the Republican side, who are almost brand new to the General Assembly or have less than 4 years of experience. These folks tend to come more from what has been always called at the national level the base. They come from areas of the state that are outside of the urban areas. And we see these folks who come in with very strong ideas. not as willing to compromise oftentimes, at least early in their tenure. But they also don't hold a lot of the positions of power in the committees, and especially the education committees and appropriations. So you're going to see this battle continue as it moves along on all of these issues, whether it's Dix or whether it's the budget or whether it's other things, where you have a group, a pretty sizable group of voters within the General Assembly who want to see big changes to the tax policy, to the budget, lots of cuts. And then you're going to see a more pragmatic approach coming from the more business-oriented Republicans, and that's Governor McCrory and most of the leadership.
Well, let's talk about that. We mentioned Dorothea Dix and now a proposal that would rescind a deal between the state and the city of Raleigh on how to use the Dorothea Dix property has made its way through. It's made it through a Senate committee. Tell us where that is and about the legislation, Jessica.
Well, it's made it through the Senate committee, and it's expected that it could land on the Senate floor sometime next week. And this proposed legislation would essentially scrap the lease that was signed between the city of Raleigh and the state, in which the city of Raleigh would lease that land for about $500,000 a year plus increases every year. And there are many legislators who have not been happy about that deal, particularly in the Senate. And it's actually mostly because Governor Perdue was behind it, at least at the end. And so they are still trying to get back at the former Democratic governor, Governor Perdue. But I will say this has also raised a great outcry among the Dix Visionaries, which was one of the major groups that got the whole idea, and the idea of the lease started, the idea for the park started, and they worked for 6 or 7 years. And so we've been seeing them at the legislature this week, walking around, visiting legislators, and even getting up to talk in some of these hearings.
Well, and that's one of the points that the supporters of the current deal will tell you, is that when lawmakers say this is a lame duck decision, they'll say, no, it goes back 10 years, and it's the culmination of 10 years hard work. And Dave, a lot of Republicans in Wake County and Raleigh are behind it.
Yeah, well, this group of Dix Visionaries, if you look at the board of directors, this is a largely Republican group. You're looking at Greg Poole, who's the director of this group, people like Robert Ingram, Charles Neely, Frank Holding, and Ann Goodnight. These are folks who give a lot of money to Republicans, some of whom are now making the decision to renege on a deal that they want very much and have worked very hard for. Ann Goodnight, for example, who's the wife of Jim Goodnight, who's the founder of SAS, last year in her home had a fundraiser for Phil Berger in which they raised $300,000. Now Phil Berger is going to have to try to work both sides of this issue, where he's going to have to keep sort of that base happy and undo a deal that largely is motivated, you know, as Jessica was saying, because it's the legacy of the former Democratic governor, Bev Perdue. But this is a deal that Republicans want as much as Democrats do. And within the sort of Raleigh Republican leadership, it's a really fascinating issue. Now, you've got folks who've raised a lot of money for the folks who are now making this decision against them.
So when the governor talked about cracks in the foundation of the economy in North Carolina, he may also have been talking about the cracks in the foundation of the Republican solid majority in government.
And what's interesting, I just put this on WNC.org, and I detail exactly who gave money to whom and how much. And it's a significant amount of money that these folks have raised for Republicans.
John, at the Carolina Public Press, out there in western North Carolina, do you see these kind of fissures, the division between the ideological base and the more pragmatic maybe professional Republicans? Does it play out in any of the issues that are in the headlines out there?
We certainly have part of that spectrum here, but I must say a lot of the focus, particularly in my part of Western North Carolina, Buncombe County, has been on very specific legislators who are introducing legislation that would affect municipalities and counties here, a good example being our Representative Tim Moffitt from this region. He's introduced a lot of legislation. You might know him best from the Nipple Bill, but he's introduced a lot of legislation that would affect the capacity of various municipalities to run and indeed keep some of their essential services.
You really are on the hook now for describing that legislation, John, but that was about covering up during protests, right?
Yes, in public, covering the nipple and the areola.
So there you go. That's some of what's on the mind of Western North Carolina legislators. We're talking about the review of the news. And one of the budget items, and John, we're going to get back to you in a second because I know this does affect you as well, in particular out there. But Governor McCrory also looked at another issue, and that was school safety. Part of his budget, creating that school safety center, Dave, what is it and what does it do? What does it address?
It's a group within the Department of Public Safety. About four people will look at a lot of – work with school boards. They'll work with all kinds of school districts, get ideas on ways that they can improve school safety. Nobody is arguing with this. Everybody thinks this is a good idea.
The Make Our Schools Unsafe Committee,
right. It's the
no longer incorporated
in North
Carolina.
That advocacy group has lost a lot of its influence, for sure. No, and in the wake of Newtown, you know, school safety is really at the top. And because, you know, academically, North Carolina schools are all over the place. Well, in terms of school safety, North Carolina schools are all over the place. I've been in hundreds of schools. Jessica, you've been in a lot of schools in this state, too. The safety varies wildly in terms of security. There are some schools that have, armed police officers, school security officers that are there almost around the clock, or at least when students are there. And there are some schools you can walk right into without any problem, and no one will stop you. You can go right into a classroom, and no one will stop you. It happens. It's everywhere. It's not just an urban-rural issue. And so, you know, school security needs to be looked at. And a lot of these issues, and it's interesting to see how much of a comprehensive look that Governor McCrory wants to take. In other states that are largely run by Republicans, a lot of the focus has been on teachers carrying guns or only having, you know, more guns in the school. But he's taking a very broad approach. He's looking at counselors. He's looking at all kinds of different ways that schools can be safer. And it'll be interesting to see how this group comes forward and what things they come up with that they want to do. And then, of course, how you fund these things, because right. These will be expensive things, whatever they come up with, because you're talking about personnel mostly.
And John Elliston, I understand school safety debate has been raging pretty intensely in your part of the state.
It has been heated after Newtown. It certainly has popped up at every single school board meeting we've been to, at many county commission meetings. And the response among the various school systems has been pretty rapid. It's run the gamut. In Buncombe County, for example, all of the schools will now be secured by video entry systems that are being put in place. In Transylvania and Swain counties, there are now armed school resource officers at every single public school. Other counties have decided they can't quite afford to invest that much, so they've taken half steps. In Henderson County, for example, sheriff's deputies each adopt a school where they'll go park while they're doing their paperwork. Similar programs underway in Haywood County, where officers will park, do paperwork, come into the cafeteria and get a free lunch and what have you. The goal being to up the security presence there, even if there's no full-time officer.
What is the fact that the western counties have the highest proportion of registered gun owners? Does that play any part in how this debate plays out in your part of the state?
It certainly has added some energy to the debate at many of these local meetings. We have had some parents, some citizens say, look, we need to arm our teachers. We need more guns in schools. We've also had teachers and administrators and regular citizens say, no, that's the opposite approach. We can find ways to beef up security without bringing many more guns into schools.
While we're on education, Dave, the legislature elected a new board of governors for the UNC system, and that was not without controversy.
It wasn't. In the past, Democrats, of course, have been in control, and they've put their people on the board of governors, but they have included some Republicans, moderate mostly Republicans. Former Governor Jim Holzhauser stands out on the UNC board of governors. That wasn't the case at all this time when the House and Senate decided to put their people on. All 16 are strong Republicans. There was one maybe moderate Democrat on there, but that and one unaffiliated. And what's really taken a hit is the diversity factor, quite frankly. You know, the UNC system includes some very highly populated and very strong HBCUs, and the diversity at the schools has increased dramatically in the last couple of decades. The UNC Board of Governors has been a fairly diverse operation over the last session or two. That's going to take a bit of a hit. We've seen of the 16, one African American was placed on the board, and the rest were white. I don't think that's viewed by most people as necessarily a good thing. It's a board that represents all the universities and all the students and all the faculty, and that is getting less white, and the board is getting more white. So in that way, it's not necessarily a good thing, but people can't be surprised by this. The Republicans were elected. They get to put their people on boards. That's how it works. And who they get to put on, it shouldn't be a surprise.
Well, Jessica, Governor McCrory was elected in part because of his appeal to voters to help brand the state. And he was going to brand this state particularly as a business-friendly kind of a place. And it does seem to me that there are some conflicts in this budget and these other decisions in terms of what message you're sending about education and about diversity. So tell us about sort of the branding campaign and how some of these issues play out in his administration.
Well, Governor McCrory has brought up this issue of wanting to rebrand North Carolina as if it were a product. He's spoken about this many, many times in the campaign trail and in his State of the State address. And that really seems to annoy the Democrats. Now, in the governor's proposed budget, he wants to give close to $3 million to the Department of Commerce to update the state's brand. And Democrats say, well, how can you rebrand and repackage the state when you're not giving a lot of money to K-12 education and to universities? And that really is one of the reasons why they say that's really one of the reasons why many people move to North Carolina, because quality of life here is good. There are good public schools, good public universities and community colleges. And, you know, there's a good quality of life here. And Democrats think that some of the major points of the governor's budget are not going to lead to a better quality of life in the future, which is North Carolina's strong selling point.
And particularly in higher education, where, you know, these right now are flagship universities and some of the best public universities in the country, certainly UNC Chapel Hill.
Right. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see. You know, one of the things that is in the budget is the funding of this strategic plan that the UNC Board of Governors is going to be implementing that will change a lot of the universities, will bring in certain things, will highlight certain aspects of the university over others. It will be interesting to see how that changes the university and university system. It's one way McCrory is sort of trying to put his imprint on it.
John, I want to talk with you and shift gears a little bit. This is a story that was not necessarily in the news this week, but has been in the news over the past couple of months, and one that the Carolina Public Press has paid close attention to. You're looking into how the sheriff's offices in your part of the state handle evidence. This started with the Asheville Police Department, expanded to Buncombe County Sheriff. Tell us a little bit about the backstory, and then tell us how you moved it forward.
Within about the past 5 years, we've had two major breaches of evidence rooms in western North Carolina. Both the Buncombe County Sheriff's Office and the Asheville Police Department had a large number of sensitive items go missing. And by sensitive items, I mean the proverbial guns, drugs, and money. No one's been charged as yet in the case of Asheville. In the case of Buncombe, our sheriff is in federal prison in Butner on unrelated corruption charges. But our hope and our goal here was to try to document just how the sheriffs in our region are managing their evidence rooms.
And you have requested more information. Those initial investigations, I think, came out of the city council and county commissions. Is that right? They had some questions that initiated these. But now you've gone out and asked other counties and other sheriff's offices for information about how they handled evidence. Is that right?
That's right. We're about midway through a process that I hope will come to fruition. We're surveying 18 sheriff's offices here. So far, about 9 or 10 of them have responded and given us the basic but critical documents we requested on how they run their evidence rooms and how they audit and inspect them.
And, of course, the problem here is because some of this evidence has been so badly mishandled, some of it is just plain missing, which raises some serious questions about the integrity of those offices. But a lot of cases just get thrown out of court because of a chain of custody questions and missing evidence. Is that right?
That's right. We've had cases delayed, cases dismissed. We've had plea deals brought down because evidence simply gone missing, and any smart defense attorney's going to pounce on that and say, well, you can't convict my client without evidence.
No, it's an important investigation, and we will keep checking in with you on that as far as to see how things continue, and probably one that perhaps could be done all across the state, but it's got to start somewhere. So, Dave, now we'll turn our attention again away from state politics and to, well, an important productivity question, because today productivity may reach an all-time low across the state. It's the second day of the NCAA men's basketball tournament. And in fact, Dave, no one is listening to us right now because Duke is playing basketball.
Right. Duke started about 20 minutes ago. They're ahead by 9, in case you're curious right now.
I was wondering, you got a laptop in front of you. I thought it might be the news, but no, it's the game. Right?
I just assumed we were going to talk about this all hour. So, no, this is a big day for the Triangle-based schools. Duke, Carolina, NC State all play today. Duke playing now and State and Carolina playing a little bit later. It'll be interesting to see. You know, the two of North Carolina's other teams that were in the tournament, North Carolina A&T and Davidson, have both lost already, although Davidson was a really heartbreaking loss. They were ahead by 5 points late in the game and ended up losing sort of at the buzzer. So Davidson always makes a great showing in the tournament, whether they win a game, win a couple games, or don't win a game at all. They always play very, very well and open people's eyes to just how good basketball
they're the
is.
Perennial Cinderella, if you can have such a thing. But A&T, that was kind of exciting.
That was. And they actually played in, well, what most people call a play-in game. The NCAA calls it the first four. They were able to win a game in the NCAA tournament, and then they were not even picked to win their conference tournament. They were down in the middle of the pack, but sort of came from out of nowhere and won the conference tournament, the MEAC, and then were able to win a game in the NCAA tournament and then faced the overall number one seed, Louisville, and did pretty well for most of the game and then lost pretty significantly.
John, we consider this kind of a triangle thing, but I suppose people in Western Carolina do care something about what happened.
Yes, we'll be watching closely tonight, and particularly closely we'll be watching Roy Williams coach the Tar Heels because he's a mountain boy. We are counting on you, Roy.
All right, Jessica, I just ask you one question. Who's going to win the tournament?
You know, I have to plead the fifth on that one. I'm sorry.
I think it's going to be a team in blue is all I'm going to say. Dave DeWitt, UNC's education reporter. Jessica Jones, our Capitol Bureau chief. John Elliston is investigations and open government editor with the nonprofit Carolina Public Press in Western North Carolina. Thanks to all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Tokyo Rosenthal plays live. Stay tuned.